snow for a time. Quite unusual, obviously, for this time of year, but it shouldn't cause us any great problems. By Wednesday, the wet and windy weather continues to clear off into the North Sea. It will do so during Wednesday morning, and then it'll leave us with more of a straightforward day of sunny spells and scattered showers, but still feeling cooler for this time of year. That's your forecast.
Louise, thank you. Now on Radio 4, a new book of the week, and political reform is on the agenda. Not today, but there was a time in the 1800s when not reforming Parliament and our voting system would have led to national revolt. Change is already in the air as the background to events is described in Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser.
The particular drama of the struggle for the Great Reform Bill of 1832 began with the death of one king and the fall of another. In June 1830, George IV, King of Great Britain, died at the age of 67. A month later, the Bourbon King of France, Charles X, was toppled. The Duke of Clarence, now William IV, had been heir presumptive to the throne for the last 3 years, ever since the death of another older brother, Frederick, Duke of York. He was 64, born in the same year as Lord Grey. As the third son, he was put into the navy early in life, where he spent his formative years. William was friendly, in contrast to what a contemporary called the haughty reserve of the late King George. His informality and love of a risque joke, especially in after-dinner speeches, aroused mixed reactions. When told that a certain person could not attend court because he did not have the right breeches, the king quipped, "Then let him come without his breeches." There was something childlike, bon enfant, about the enjoyment of his new position. In May 1830, Lord Anglesey predicted that he would be wild, arbitrary, prejudiced, and unmanageable, but admitted that he might be popular. There was, however, one aspect of his character which would prove to be of considerable significance in the years to come. William was uxorious and shared the conjugal bedroom. When the messengers came to tell the new king of the old king's death at Bushy Park in the early hours of the morning, William was said to have retired to bed afterwards with the words, "I've never been to bed with a queen before." The court, created around this happily domestic couple, might lack excitement compared to that Whig paradise of hospitality, Holland House. According to the diarist Charles Greville, Queen Adelaide sat around embroidering flowers of an evening, while William dozed, occasionally waking to say, "Exactly so, ma'am," before going to sleep again. But fashionable Whig despair, Lady Grey commenting on the unendurable boredom of 2 days at Windsor, did not mean that the strength of the Central Royal Union could be ignored. The death of an hereditary monarch meant there was a need for an immediate general election. The present Prime Minister, the so-called Iron Duke of Wellington, the victor of Waterloo, had led the Tory government since January 1828. William IV had been suspected of Whig sympathies before his accession, though he took pains to reassure Wellington of the continuance of his favour. Nevertheless, the Tory government was no longer the force it had once been. The passing of the Act for Catholic Emancipation in 1829 had reft the party, and a powerful group had emerged, known as ultra-Tories, who despised the government for their submission to pressure over principle. That the campaign for Catholic emancipation had been divisive was illustrated by the seemingly bizarre behaviour of certain ultra-Tories, such as the Marquis of Blandford, accusing Wellington and Robert Peel of betraying the Protestant constitution in response to the menaces of Jesuits and Jacobins. He decided that a House of Commons which could pass such an act must be in need of, what else? But reform. he introduced a bill to that effect in February 1830. It was surely impossible for reform not to feature in the coming reign. After years of languishing, the topic was once again assuming some kind of national importance, and by a strange coincidence, the Second French Revolution was there again to exercise its cross-channel influence, for better or for worse. It was relevant that the Duke of Wellington, the hero of the nation, had defeated the French at Waterloo. The new king, as a young man in the navy, had fought bravely on the English side. The Whig grandees, on the other hand, were by inclination and heredity pro-French. Lord Holland, the nephew of the Whigs' hero Charles James Fox, had hailed the glorious changes in France. In 1830, according to Greville, the thermometer at Greenwich was lower than it had been for the last 90 years. A series of appalling harvests, followed by severe winter weather, meant the poor were starving. Britain was already in the throes of economic distress following the end of the Napoleonic Wars. Most notoriously in the past, such dire conditions had led to the so-called Peterloo Massacre near Manchester in 1819, when a group led by the radical orator Henry Hunt had demanded political reform as a solution to the problem. There were an estimated 11 deaths at the time at the hands of the military and over 400 injured. Henry Hunt was arrested and sentenced to 2.5 years in prison in a jail which he nicknamed the Ilchester Bastille. Agricultural distress arrived in a new form as machines came to supplant men, and men sought revenge by breaking up the new machines. The campaign took its name from its leader, Captain Swing. Was he a man or a myth? It began in East Kent, where landowners might expect to find the following menacing message left overnight. Revenge for thee is on the wing from thy determined Captain Swing. These poor creatures, taking refuge in violence, had no part in the parliamentary election. Just over 3% of the population voted in 1830. All, of course, were male. There were 658 seats allotted to the United Kingdom, and the total number of constituencies was 379. Within the simplicity of these figures, however, was concealed a system of fiendish variety and intricacy, just because it had originated so many centuries ago. When Oliver Cromwell had supported the abolition of the House of Lords in the middle of the 17th century, he had referred to its members as lumps of gilded earth. The contemptuous phrase expressed the fact that the Lords derived their existence from being landowners. The current parliamentary system by which patrons of pocket boroughs nominated individuals to enjoy the seats which were considered to belong to them meant that members of the Lords were an important force in any election. "May not I do what I like with my own?" exclaimed the Duke of Newcastle in a notorious bout of indignation when the abolition of certain seats of which he had the patronage was proposed. There had been virtually no alteration in the original medieval scheme since 1760. Furthermore, the phenomenon now termed the Industrial Revolution had been totally ignored, and there were no parliamentary seats attached to teeming, choking, productive cities such as Birmingham, Sheffield, and Manchester. In the meantime, there were the infamous rotten boroughs, such as Old Sarum, where 2 MPs represented, quite literally, a lump of stone and a green field. No wonder visitors flocked to see this miraculous sight. In early October, Grey and his wife Mary left their beloved northern estate of Howick in Northumberland for Westminster. Throughout the period which lay ahead, Grey's yearning for his country home was to be a feature of his conduct. Grey, the contented family man, was perhaps unconsciously atoning for that time when, as a reckless young aristocrat, whose patrician look was doted upon by Lord Byron, had begotten an illegitimate child by Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire. Where Grey's looks were concerned, the romantic black curls had long ago receded, but they had left a splendid dome of a head on which every caricaturist seized with enthusiasm. His figure, however, was still slender, that figure which had caused him to be nicknamed Lanky at Eton. Grey was strongly idealistic where parliamentary reform was concerned. When he declared at the opening of Parliament in 1830 that, "Through my whole life I have advocated reform," it was fundamentally true, even if Wellington had put it rather more crudely that summer. Grey, he told Harriet Arbuthnot, was both arrogant and very obstinate, with all kinds of fantastic notions about reform in Parliament. The Duke of Wellington, leader of the Tories, was at 61, 5 years younger than Grey. 15 years after Waterloo, it would be impossible to exaggerate the nationwide esteem in which he was held, and of course physically, he was unmistakable, with what the painter Haydon called his greyhound eyes and his eagle nose. But Wellington had a certain detachment from ordinary concerns. Where dealing with the riotous was concerned, in 1830 he observed to Greville with grim pride that his own regiment alone could take on all the population of London. When Wellington was told that there might nonetheless be conflict with the people, he reportedly exclaimed, "Bah! Bah!" In Birmingham, on the 11th of October, 1830, a dinner was held to celebrate the recent French Revolution. It was at Beardsworth's Repository, the chief centre for the sale of horses in the Midlands, capable of holding, as on this occasion, nearly 4,000 people. The food was lavish, and the whole feast was under the auspices of the Birmingham Political Union, founded with Thomas Attwood as its first president in December 1829. Attwood was at this point in his late 40s, a county banker, a man of great solidity of character, who was at the same time an inspiring leader. He held the conviction that the interests of masters and men were in fact one. "If the masters flourish, the men are certain to flourish with them." When Attwood sat for Haydon, the painter noted that his whole appearance spoke of vigour, his carriage upright, his very hair seeming to grow upwards, and the blood rushing into his face when he talked on his favourite subject. Attwood's particular hobby horse was the reform of English finance by enlarging the money supply, and he was convinced that parliamentary reform was necessary to achieve this. Attwood was, however, determined not to be defined as advocating popular violence, however good the cause. The motto of the Union was the Constitution, nothing less, nothing more. But Attwood's demand for peaceful change was in contrast to events taking place elsewhere in the country. The first threshing machine was destroyed at a village near Canterbury on the 28th of August 1830, and by October, the Times was referring to an organisational system of stack burning.
Adrian Scarborough was reading from Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser, which has been abridged for radio by Catherine Williams and produced by Duncan Mitchell. Tomorrow we meet the Committee of Four at the same time. Thank you. And now on Radio 4, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Tuesday the 14th of May. There are warnings of gales in Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Trafalgar, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Island.